Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Thursday, April 25th. We have two items on our agenda. We will take them in the order in which the agenda is printed. I want to let you know that when we get to the second item, which is a work session on House Bill 2184A, we indeed will have an opportunity for a little bit of discussion about that, but we will not be voting today on House Bill 2184A. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3307.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. House Bill 3307 comes to us from the House Committee on Healthcare. Very briefly, this bill requires the Oregon Health Authority to assess a fee on emergency medical service providers, and those funds are then used to enhance federal financial participation in the cost of providing these emergency transport services, and additionally to supporting quality improvement efforts.
Thank you. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Finley, Vice Chair Marsh, and Member Reske. Good morning. I'm Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, Monmouth Independence, West Salem, South Salem. Thank you for consideration of House Bill 3307. The bill was passed out of the House Committee on Healthcare without recommendation because of time. It was introduced, actually, by the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. And although we didn't have an opportunity for a discussion on the merits of the measure, I believe there would actually be support for this in terms of the intended outcomes. That said, I'm not supporting the measure as the chairman of the committee, but rather as an individual member with a background in complex issues involved with emergency management and delivery. To begin with, we, all of us in Oregon, need a comprehensive network of emergency response providers. And right now, we do not have anything close to the robust structures and systems we should have. 3307 does nothing little or more than maintain what we already have through optimizing models used throughout the healthcare complex. This bill is not building new. It is seeking to preserve the critical life services communities throughout Oregon depend upon now, today, and likely into tomorrow. Not long ago, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, called CMS, I don't know why it's not CMMS, but nonetheless, CMS determined that the Ground Emergency Medical Transportation, another acronym, GEMT, should only be approved for public providers. And while ambulance services are determined through actions taken by public bodies, an issue that Representative Finley and I had some time to study this past session regarding ambulance service districts, counties have that responsibility, public entities. Nonprofit and private providers for ground emergency medical transport services are not deemed eligible by CMS. In other words, public providers are eligible for federal support. Nonpublic providers, even when and if selected by a county as the most sustainable option because of the unique situations, are not eligible. House Bill 3307 provides a vehicle for bridging the gap in fairness, allowing participating nonprofit and private providers to pay a fee based upon the amount of emergency transports provided, and then leveraging that amount as a match for Medicaid reimbursements. Please note, public providers will not pay the fee ever. Truth be told, it is a convoluted solution, as many of our solutions are these days, but it's also necessary. Our existing patchwork approach to funding medical services, especially for the young, aging, and most at risk economically, is a mess. The needs are growing. This bill would not remedy that overarching challenge, but it would, in fact, provide a mechanism to ensure that we maintain at least existing service levels throughout the state of Oregon. This bill is needed because we do not have the ability to absorb the impact of its absence. Nonprofits and private providers are already stretched to the limits by the increasing costs associated with more patients in need. As we all know, people are living longer, and as a result, an aging population requires more care. On top of that, our lingering struggle with poverty puts even more stress upon an already undercapitalized system. This measure also provides fairness for providers who exist because of a specific need. We have a blended system of delivery, public, nonprofit, private, because of the unique requirements of different locations and their underlying economy, geography, and population. 3307 is a necessary remedy for the challenges we face today, and I ask you to consider it for passage. I'll try to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Evans, for being here on this. And this question goes to you or someone you want to defer it to. I'm just interested
Certified
in
smart
where
people come on up.
Interested in where we wind up in terms of equity up between public providers and private providers. I understand the public providers have a whole different reimbursement system based on costs and the gap between costs. I understand that this provides a matching dollar figure. So the question is, when all that's taken into account, where would private and public providers wind up in relationship with each other?
So I will leave I'll defer the specifics to the folks behind me, but the organizations that are in support of this, those that are behind me, hopefully walking up, I can't see right now if they are, they're actually a mix of public and private providers. And as a group, they recognize that because of the inequality in the system right now, that the privates and nonprofits that are often used in areas where publics no longer can do it, they're put at even greater risk. And I don't know that this will actually get them to parity, but I think it's an attempt to try to get them to parity.
Sure. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Sean Baird. I'm the owner and operator of Woodburn Ambulance Service and also the president of the Oregon State Ambulance Association and recently became president-elect of the American Ambulance Association. To get right to that question before I cover other stuff.
And for right now, please just answer that question because then I'll call you up with the others of the panel and then you can speak
about
great. Whatever you want.
The GEMT allows for the public provider to to submit their actual cost of providing service to the Medicaid patient and makes up the difference between whatever that reported cost is and what they received under normal Medicaid reimbursement. The proposal in this bill for privates, when we put forward our contribution on 5% of all of our emergency calls, that creates, and then that goes in to get a federal match, and that creates the pool of money, which would raise our Medicaid rate, we estimate about $287. So that would put us still slightly typical cost of providing an ambulance service to Medicaid around Oregon. We estimated about $700 for the private and nonprofit sector. This would raise us to just below that $700 in total Medicaid reimbursement. So not quite parity with what the GEMT program does with public providers, but gets us very close.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I do, but I'll wait till he gives his other little speech.
Thank
I have several.
Evans.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
To join Mr. Baird at the table, please, Randy Lauer and Mike Lepin.
Great, thank you. And I'll just start off by a brief introduction. The Oregon State Ambulance Association is made up of both public and private, nonprofit, some hospital-based providers from all over the state. We cover about 80% of the emergency transports are provided around the state are covered by these private and nonprofit providers, with the balance being covered with fire-based services. So when we talk today, we're going to kind of represent a range of I'm in Woodburn, cover rural area all the way up into the Silver Falls area, and Randy is from AMR, which covers Multnomah and Clackamas counties, and Mike is east of the Cascades. So you'll kind of hear a perspective from quite a variety of the state. In 2016, when the legislature passed 4030, we worked very hard to be able to try and hopefully include everybody in that. So we would all just be moving from the same Medicaid scheme we were on together, regardless of provider type, to the new version, again, regardless of provider type. Unfortunately, when it went up to the federal level, it was determined that states would not be able to include the non-governmental entities in that program, which is kind of what led us to today's proposal. So last spring we began talking about it. Once that was clear that CMS wouldn't make it equal for all players, we thought, what else can we do? And the obvious solution was to look at what other healthcare providers did to leverage federal match dollars with provider assessments. And we found that in California they had a model specifically for ambulance service with the Quality Assurance Fund that they basically followed the same process when GEMT went through there, and then they followed it up in a subsequent session with a different alternative for the other providers. So that's what today's legislation is based upon. And when we went through that process, we wanted to make sure that everybody had the option to, again, just like with 4030, that any provider would have the option. So we went to the Fire Chiefs Association. We have many fire representatives who are part of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. We had a series of meetings in the spring to make sure that if they wanted to be included in this particular version of it, that they could be. And over between like April and August of last year, they ultimately decided that they'd prefer we move ahead with this without them in it. Not to say that they couldn't change their mind in the future and come back and want to participate in this program, but they felt like GEMT was adequate for their needs at this time. So that kind of tees up where we are today. And Randy, I don't know if you want to talk a little more detail.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. As Sean mentioned, I'm Randy Lauer. I'm with American Medical Response, and we provide the 911 ambulance service in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Josephine counties in Oregon. So the program housed in House Bill 3307 would work like this. Participating non-public providers would pay a 5% fee on all of their emergency transport, so not just the Medicaid beneficiaries, but all other transported patients as well. And that works out to roughly $34 per call based on our modeling. 10% of that fee would stay with the state, and that would be divided. Half would go to the OHA to administer the program. We estimate that's about $300,000 a year, and half would go to the CCOs to initiate in the form of a grant to any participating provider, and that's about $300,000 too. An example of what CCOs might award a grant for would be a community paramedic program or something like that, mobile integrated healthcare, which is really paramedics going out before the call, working with medically fragile patients who live in the community to try to help them keep from going into acute medical crisis. So that's what a community paramedic program does. This could potentially help fund parts of that. So the rest of the money would go to the federal government to receive the match, which would be distributed through the CCOs and back to the participating providers. And as Sean mentioned, modeling shows that that should be roughly $287 a call, which gets us close to the cost, the average cost to provide ambulance services by non-public providers in our state. So we think, and it's already been kind of discussed, and I think Representative Evans did a very good job of introducing it, but it really kind of levels the playing field. GMT, we tried to make that a level playing field for everybody, and it went from the state to the CMS, and it changed at CMS. So this bill is really kind of a companion to GMT that kind of levels that opportunity for all types of providers in Oregon. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
We'll wait till the last.
Thank you.
The last testimony, and then we'll do some questions.
And good morning. My name is Mike Lapine. I'm the chief of Jefferson County EMS and located in Madras, Oregon. We're a non-fire-based EMS service in that area. We cover the 911 responses, and we have a good tie with a lot of the other volunteer agencies outside our area. We currently do the billing for Fossil Ambulance. That is an all-volunteer service there. We're currently negotiating to do the billing services for Spray Ambulance. With our business, we do a lot of associations with quite a few non-fire-based volunteer systems besides Fossil, Spray. There's Conda in Arlington, Maupin, all these in Wheeler, Gillam, and Wasco counties. Some of my meetings with them before struggle with their finance or their budget on trying to maintain their service. There's already an issue with trying to maintain or recruit new volunteers, and part of the problems that come with that are the finances. Recently, in a discussion we had, it was a matter of trying to put together EMT courses so they can recruit more people and get them certified to work on their ambulances. But often these courses are more than 2 hours away. There are some options that can make these classes a little bit closer and away from those community colleges, but still, even when they try to band together these smaller agencies to create a class, it still provides a travel distance of at least an hour. And then there's the cost. An average EMT class at a college, community college is two terms long, so that takes these people away from their livelihood for at least two times a week to make it to these courses, study time for these courses, and then their expense of not only the course, but the expense of maintaining their certification. There's a requirement of maintaining these hours of education so they can recertify every 2 years. And when you're living way out there, sometimes it's hard to be able to make it to those courses. Classes aren't always available out there in the farmland outside Fossil, and so they may have to go to seminars, conferences, whatnot, and that also creates quite the expense. And then even maintaining their vehicles. My small department, if we have four ambulances but two that we keep up all the time, we budget about $11,000 a year to maintain those. Places like Condon maintain two ambulances as well. They don't run near as many calls as we do, but that still creates quite the stress for them to be able to maintain that fleet and maintain their personnel, as well as supplies. My agency is fortunate that we have ALS staff, meaning we staff with paramedics, but all of these other agencies I'm talking about, the highest level they have are EMT intermediates, which are able to start IVs. Those supplies get expensive and some of those expire. An easy IO, which is if they can't start an IV, they can go into intraosseous or under the bone. Those needles are over $100 a piece, and that really straps their expenses. And the medications that they carry also expire. So this thing can really help with increase your budget and make it more possible to keep those EMTs in the field and provide those responses that are very what we call super rural.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a couple of questions. And I've read this bill and I didn't understand it. I had a discussion yesterday with someone and I understand it better. And I read it again and I still have more questions. I am very familiar with ambulance operations. This appears that public non-fire department ambulance services will have to pay this fee. Is that a true statement or not a true statement? Such as in Harney County, the ambulance service is run by the hospital. It's not associated with the fire department at all.
Same in Dundee.
Same in Baker City.
And state.
In Ontario, it's a private for-profit company. In Vail, it is they park in the same building as the fire department, but they are separate. They have a chief of each division. So it makes it a little muddy and ugly. And the issue is most of these folks run at the present time between 62 and 82% of return on their dollar they spend now on the amount of money that they recoup from Medicaid and Medicare. If these are the non-fire groups that are assessed this 5% fee, then their fees, their return on their dollars they spend just dropped by 5%, and that seems a little hard for them. Did I interpret that correctly?
The 5% is intended to then, you know, that's what goes to the feds to get the match, which then raises their reimbursement by $287 on the Medicaid call. So actually they get a substantial return on the participation. That's the premise.
So the GMET program, has it sent a dollar out to the, is it in operation as we speak?
The report that we just got back from OHA staff was that they will receive their first money, I believe, at the end of this year. But there's a representative from the GEMT program at the state here.
So this body passed in 2016, House Bill 4030, which established the GMET program. It's now 2019, and we haven't realized any money back out of it. So I guess I wonder why.
I guess I would defer that to to the OHA.
And that's fine. I appreciate that. So, the old saying, a lick and a promise is not the best thing in the world. And this, while I understand trying to balance budgets, managing an ambulance service district, and it's tough to do, and it's tough to staff them, you're absolutely right on training and getting folks to volunteer their life away to do this. And this is not the most fun work at all. It's darn hard work, but I'm still trying to figure out whether this is a good bill or not, and I can't get there very well. And what concerns me more than anything is I talked to an ambulance service director this morning, who, that's his full-time job. He's a retired paramedic from another department, and he runs a service district for Malheur County. He'd never heard of either one of these programs before. And I think, how can that be? I mean, how can people that do this full-time not know about this program?
Representative Finley.
I'll quit now.
We have one other person who signed up to speak, and I would be happy to call a representative from OHA up following that for a brief discussion or response to the issues that have been raised. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief, thank you.
Thank you.
Next will be Genoa Ingram. And my hope is for us to conclude this hearing in probably about 10 minutes. We need at least 5 or 10 for the next time.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Genoa Ingram today representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. They are the elected officials who oversee our rural fire protection districts. The Oregon Fire District Directors were one of the proponents of House Bill 4030, the GEMT bill. And at that time, we never anticipated that the CMS would differentiate between private and publics, hospital-owned, et cetera. We all thought that everybody would be on a level playing field. And so we were surprised. Representative Finley's question, at our conferences, we have been getting regular updates on GEMT since passage of House Bill 4030, and our understanding from the Fire Chiefs Association is that it was a long process to get that program approved at the federal level. The hangup was not at the state level, it was at the federal level. So we believe that the 3307 cures an inequity that currently exists. The fire district directors currently have nothing to gain from passage of this bill because we will fall under the GEMT program. However, we are a collaborative organization and we believe that everybody should be on the same footing, and we believe that this bill accomplishes that. I will point out that we do have an amendment, the dash one, that includes or that exempts the fire districts from the program since we are already under GEMT. And the original bill as written currently exempts fire departments, and I think it was maybe a drafting error that departments and districts weren't included also. But happy to answer any questions. We've kind of been on the sidelines. The GEMT was, you know, that was not our, we were not one of the primary proponents, but we did support it. We think it's a good program. We are very eager to see it. How it works, and we have a lot of faith in that program. We would just like to see everyone else on the same footing and have the same opportunity, which is what we thought we were doing back when 4030 passed. Thank you.
If there is someone here from Oregon Health Authority, it has been suggested that you might have some information or responses for us.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and representatives of the committee. My name is Blake Jamison. I am the director of the Emergency Medical Transportation Programs for the Health Systems Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I stepped into this position in December of last year, 2018. Previously, I directed the GEMT equivalent program in the state of Texas, and I've assisted on some work in other states with GEMT types of programs. So, stepping back to the initial question, I think that's been asked several times, and it seems to be floating around amongst the EMS providers, is what took so long to get the GEMT program passed, being that House Bill 4030 was passed back in 2016. The really complicated issue that we're seeing with House Bill 4030 is that at the time that 4030 was passed, CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, was allowing what's called pass-through payment programs. And these pass-through payment programs are generally how these GEMT programs have been passed in various different states. And so with House Bill 4030 passing in February of 2016, CMS issued the final MCO, the Managed Care Organization Regulations, on April 25th of 2016, which was 2 months after 4030 was passed and complicated how this program was going to get funded. Being that CMS has phased out these pass-through payment programs, it's been challenging to try to figure out what the alternative is going to be to get this program funded. There are two elements to the House Bill 4030. So you have your fee-for-service Medicaid recipients-based funding and then your coordinated care organization. So there's kind of two parts to 4030. With the fee-for-service related funding with 4030, the Oregon Health Authority had a state plan amendment approved by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I believe it was April of 2018, so half of the bill, in essence, has been passed, and we are currently operationalizing that with our first cost reporting period. So this is a cost-based program beginning this summer, so we'll have EMS providers submit those cost reports to us August 1st, and payments issued for services beginning, which was what the bill was passed on, for services beginning July 1st of 2017, with those payments being issued in December. The coordinated care organization element, CMS funds that differently. So we are not able to submit the a request for the same funding package, in essence, a state plan amendment for the coordinated care organization-based funding for this program. So we are working out options to try to figure out a new way, being that these pass-through payment programs are no longer an option to get this funded. And we've had several meetings within the last couple of months to discuss this, and we believe that we have a really good option to get this funded. We've received the green light from CMS to pursue this funding mechanism. That'll actually align with some of the other programs that are out there and create some measures and metrics within the state of Oregon that are going to reduce unnecessary EMS spending and assist the EMS providers in the administration of their services. And so this is a similar issue that we will likely encounter with House Bill 3307 if that passes. You'll see that there are two parts to this program, really. The bill discusses funding this for fee-for-service-based transports and the procedure codes associated with that. But in Section 6, this also discusses the implementation of coordinated care organization-based transports. So you see the similarity with House Bill 4030. And so with the work that we're doing, yes, it's 3 years late, but with the work that we're doing and the conversations that we're having with CMS right now, that would actually allow for the administration of this program as well.
Thank you. Representative Findlay.
Quick question. I know we want to move on. I'm sorry, but I struggle with this. I mean, you say that you're going to start receiving invoices and start making payments in July when districts don't even know about this program. I mean, I think you're ambitious with your schedule, because I don't believe there's been sufficient outreach to educate the people that provide it the further you get away from Salem on this program. And the expectations that you portray, and that we're going to start going back as far as 2017, reviewing invoices and making payments, I don't believe you've formalized what that's going to entail and what you're going to accept. And you're going to put a phenomenal workload on people, say, go back in the last 2 years and do your runs. I mean, my ambulance service district that I'm very familiar with makes about 700 runs per year. The one in Harney County makes 900 runs per year. I'm struggling that I think this program has not been very well managed, not been very well publicized. And once you get out into Eastern Oregon, I think you have a lot of work to do. And I'm not sure, you haven't implemented 4030 yet, so I'm not sure why we should do another bill for you not to implement any faster. So you gotta figure out how to convince me that you'll do what you're gonna do.
Thank you, Representative Finley. And I think your concerns are very legitimate. So we actually have three training sessions for the governmental providers for House Bill 4030, the GEMT program, scheduled in the month of May. We have a training session for what we did is we looked at transporting agencies and kind of spread a map across the state and looked at some of the areas that we thought would be the best to hold these training sessions. So we will have three live, in-person, about four-hour-long training sessions next month to work with these providers and educate them on how to submit these cost reports, what they need to do. One will be at the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, at their facility in Wilsonville. That will be our first session. Our second session is going to be held in Redmond. And then our third session, we had considered having a Southern Oregon-based training opportunity, but found that Eugene would be a little bit better. That helps some of those coastal areas. And there weren't as many Southern Oregon-based transporting agencies. And so we will have three training opportunities again next month in May to educate these providers and assist with any questions, as well as we have our Rules Advisory Committee meeting being held tomorrow to discuss rules.
Quick follow-up, I guess. So do you realize that from my house to Redmond is 290 miles? There's a whole lot of Oregon east of Redmond. And I spoke with the ambulance service provider that does all of Mount Hair County. He's a county employee, that's all he does. He knew nothing about this program 30 minutes ago. So your outreach still isn't working. And the fact that you're gonna stop the trainings in Central Oregon and not go to Eastern Oregon, where there's a whole lot of real small rural providers, as you get more dispersed, you know, I think you're missing the mark. And I would encourage you to come by sometime and we'll visit about this offline. So, thank you.
Any questions? I came here from Texas more than 40 years ago. Once I got to Oregon, I stayed put, so welcome to Oregon.
I was born and raised in Oregon, so I'm just coming back, but thank you.
So you know what Texas is like.
It'll always be my second home. I was in Austin, and then I moved to Houston for a bit, but yeah.
I want to follow up on something that Representative Findlay mentioned. In another committee, in another session a long time ago, when we were talking with another agency not related to Oregon Health Authority at all, there was quite a bit of dissatisfaction with the lack of training and lack of outreach. And one of the reasons or explanations that was provided was it's too expensive. There's nothing that can replace at least one in-person meeting to get to know someone. You know, you look them in the eye and you have that conversation. But after that, we were just totally baffled why, even though this was a few years ago, we were totally baffled why that particular agency hadn't thought of using video conferencing or webinars to stay in touch with people. It was not on their radar screen at all. And that is another way that we're used to bridging that divide. Of course, it does take broadband access. But once we overcome that problem, that is a way people stay connected. Young people are used to connecting that way all the time. I don't know why why we can't.
There's a state-sponsored network in place as we speak.
Yes.
Oregon State University.
That's right. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Chair Nathanson. And I apologize. So to add to that, we actually will be telecasting these training opportunities. And so after every opportunity, we'll have a live feed. And at the very end of it, we will work through and take all of the comments, review the training presentations, and work on a presentation that can stay up on the website until that next cost reporting period begins, and we can provide updates if there are any updates within the state or maybe from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but these will be available. And we are in the middle of working with OIS on having our GEMT website up and running, and I am very hopeful that we will be able to have that completed by the time these first cost reports are available. I know the Fire Chiefs Association does have a GEMT coalition website that they are using, and in the meantime, they are posting any of these trainings, opportunities, and anything on behalf of OHA materials that we can share while our website is being published. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think that's all the grilling we're going to do for today. There is no one else signed up to testify for this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3307. And committee will be at ease for just a minute or so. We're supposed to stop at quarter till. I'm not going to. I'll go till 5 till.
You can go ahead and start. You just can't the corn the state.
Yeah.
Move it.
Yeah.
Brush kids right.
I spread them all out. Benty is only 5. So he's still on my like little munchkin.
Okay.
But I had Lenny when I first moved to Oregon. Took the dog to the shelters.
Cool.
Yeah. So we moved all over, but they've all been born in Oregon.
You missed the phone.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. We're back in business here. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2184A.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I have a short presentation on OUSF funding given House Bill dealing with OUSF funding, and I'm going to try and make this a little short. We have about 10 minutes that we're going to talk about this for. So I just wanted to say that the Oregon Universal Service Fund is currently applied to wireline providers, so it does exist already, and the PUC in its rulemaking has issued a couple orders around the Universal Service Fund. So I'm not going to read through this slide, but I want to note that they have established objectives for the fund, also regarding their contribution criteria and the distribution criteria, which from a 30,000 foot level is intended to make sure that basic service is available to all Oregonians. And then the Public Utility Commission also establishes criteria for the recipients. So the fund is established, and then there are distributions made to providers to make sure that service is available even in areas where the cost is very high. And that burden of making sure that the service is available is borne by the Oregon Universal Service Fund and the providers themselves, and also the Federal Universal Service Fund. And so the Public Utility Commission in their order has established the objectives for the fund and also the criteria for the recipients of the distribution. So I'll just admit, looking at this from far away, that yellow lettering is bad. It's really hard to tell on my laptop.
But it's a nice looking pie.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice looking pie. And I'm interrupting myself for a second to just say thank you to the chair and to my boss, to my two girls are here today, and I'm really happy to have them and that they're able to come to work with me today.
And I see some other kids in the audience with us. I'm very glad you're here with us watching what we do, watching what your moms do.
Thank you. I think we're here today. 2184 is dealing with the Universal Service Fund because if you can think of that pie, that fund as a pie, the pie has been shrinking. So 8.5% of, I'll call them for right now, accessible revenues on wired telecom is taken and contributed to the fund. And as we all know, that the telecom industry and our preferences and all of the things surrounding our phone usage has changed. And so a lot of people are moving to landline or from landlines to cell phone lines. And so this pie has been shrinking at approximately 7% per year, or the fund is shrinking. I will say that if you look at the bottom right column, the distributions, the money that's going out, it is true that the distributions to those service providers have also been shrinking, but the Public Utility Commission has been intentionally sort of prorating some of those distributions in order to not shortchange the fund. The commission doesn't have the authority to borrow in order to provide these distributions. So there's this sort of revolving balance, and you can see at the end of the year, 10, 7, 8, 6, there's a shrinking kind of ending balance. It's a revolving fund to make sure it doesn't go below or hit zero. So the bill seeks to expand the pie by including wireless providers and VoIP. And I just want to give this new pie, and there's some disagreement on what the sort of proportions of orange or blue would be. And there's a small disagreement, I think, or disagreement might be a strong word, unknown. The future is very unknown. And so there's going to be this pie, if 2184 gets passed, of wireline provider revenues and wireless provider revenues and VoIP provider revenues. And those will be, in the current bill, with accessible revenues, taxed at, the fee would be assessed at 7%. But the VoIP portion is relatively small. So any uncertainty about the VoIP portion is small relative to the uncertainty of the wireless and the wireline providers. So the way that we are going to look at this, or I've been looking at this, is there's some current base, which is some of that information is known because it's wired and it's already being assessed, the Universal Service Fund, and then adding to that VoIP and wireless or cell phone providers. Some tiny bit of terminology, because there's acronyms in every field. Average revenue per user. This is important because if you have like a $40 bill and we're trying to assess a fee of say 7% on the telecom revenues, it's not 7% on the total bill. So we're going to look at revenue per user, and there's a difference between intrastate retail revenue and interstate retail revenue and international revenue. So the bill is sort of broken up into those three parts, or you can think of it as all the calls that you make, they either end in your state, out of your state, or in another country. And there's something called a safe harbor, and this is an attempt. The FCC has an electable default. So the percentage that's considered intrastate, which is the calls that go within your state, there's a default percentage that is set by the FCC that companies can choose to elect, or they can do something called a traffic study where they kind of demonstrate what percentage of their calls go in-state and which percentage of their calls go out-of-state. Okay. So 2184 does a few things. It establishes a new revenue base by including wireless and VoIP. It also changes the new rate cap. It moves it from 8.5% to 7%. But sort of new in this. It also establishes an overall cap for the fund and adds broadband fund. So there's $30 million total cap for the fund, so it can't exceed that. And then the broadband fund is an additional $10 million on that. Okay, so what is the cap and where is it? So these are two very separate caps. There's the $30 million fund and their fund cap and $10 million broadband fund cap. And that would be a cap that would be for all the revenues that were collected for the year. And the 7% cap on eligible revenues would be applied separately to that. So the way that it would work if this bill were to pass would be that if getting towards the end of the year, or in talking to the Public Utility Commission, they operate to an 8.5% cap already. So they work with a third-party provider, and also internally they have multiple meetings throughout the quarters and send out notices to their participants that they collect from that they are going to be collecting a smaller amount or a larger amount as they're getting closer or further from that cap. And so the approach in the $30 million and $10 million cap would be similar in that if they were starting to approach the $30 million and $10 million cap and it was, say, month 7, then they would start to ratchet down from 7% to 6% or 5% to make sure that they remain under that total funding cap. On the other hand, you could be to the 11th month and you would be at $20 million and you would still never be able to raise the rates beyond the 7% cap. So there's these two caps that function sort of as backstops for each other in the bill. Okay, so just trying to put this in the way that I think of things, there's all telecom revenue, all revenue that comes from the telecom industry. And the federal USF fund applies to interstate and international revenues, or the portion essentially that they're collecting on your bill. And then the OUSF fund applies only to the intrastate portion. And so when we're looking at the percentage, say 7%, that that the fee will be assessed on, that is actually a particular component of this, which is just that part, the telecom portion of the intrastate revenue or portion of your bill, if we're putting it sort of loosely. So the information portion, which involves ISP and data, that is treated a little bit separately. And the FCC, I put in the very end of the slides after the slide I always put that says the end, there's an informational portion that has what the FCC states for discerning these different things. And so if you were thinking of it as telecom revenue and interstate, international, and intrastate revenue, I'm going to skip to a little.
This is a great presentation, but I know we have to get to slide 16.
Okay. Okay. And I'm so glad that you always have me put numbers on my slides. Oh, the back. I just want to say that this is the wireless revenue that would be accessible for the fund, and this is what's been happening to wireless revenue over the past 15 years. And you can see that, over two to three years ago was the last official reported information by the FCC. So that's like the point where in 2016, you have data, which it was around $15. But the trend seems to be that it's going downward at sort of varying rates. And so that there's some scenario analysis in the that would say if you were to try to raise a certain amount of money the worst case scenario, so to speak, or could go lower, but contemplating that you could only access $8 per line, if you set a 6% cap, you would raise about $34 million in total if you follow the green line. If you set a 7% cap, you would raise approximately $40 million in total, and you can see how that would work out. Those are sort of moving forward to 2019, 2020 numbers, and then the future is more unknown. That's how the two caps would work. And I'm sorry I went over.
No, this is really great. Are there questions for LRO right now?
Perhaps another.
And we can do more.
Okay.
Very good.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Gresham.
And I don't have a question. I just have a comment, so I don't know if we're going to be looking at this again in the future, and I'll reserve my comment for then if that's...
We will.
Okay. Then I'll just wait. Thanks.
I have another opportunity to talk about this.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Jane. That's it. Okay. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2184A. There is no other business before us this morning. Thank you all for being here. We're adjourned.